When you're feeling bored or blue, watch out for the munchies. They find ways of making you munch when you're not hungry.
Here, munch this.
Here, munch that.
Soon you're not just bored, you're fat.
Go on out, find stuff to do. Get munching off your mind. Soon you'll see you're feeling great with the munchies left behind.
Watch out for the munchies. Another nutritional message from...
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today you're going to hear a conversation between Matt Long and Paige Smathers, who runs Nutrition Matters podcast. We've had her on a couple of times before. We've done an interview like this with her a couple of times before, but I think this is the first time we're actually getting one published, which is pretty dang awesome. So listen in to Matt and Paige and look out for the munchies.
It says recording. I see it.
Oh, you see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So at Sunstone the other day when I presented, I was kind of rejuvenated in doing infants, and specifically on a series of interviews I want to start doing, which I'm calling the School of the Teachers, which is to bring teachers and present them to people that hopefully will become their own teachers. That's essentially my philosophy. What do you think about that, Paige?
I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's my first time hearing about it. That sounds great.
Yeah. And you were the first person that came to mind.
Oh my gosh. I'm so honored. That's
yeah. Nice of you. And so listeners wouldn't know that Paige has been on Infants on Thrones, like probably about 6 hours worth of recording.
Yeah.
It was like a Delinean level of detail we've gone into of hours, and none of it's got punished. None of it's got published. The only one that's
except
been
for the Randy stuff.
Yeah, the Randy. that's right. The pseudoscience stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. So the only ones that's been punished was Paige by us constantly taking up her time and not being published. But that was my fault 100%. But so here we go. Round three.
I love it.
Paige, introduce yourself.
So my name's Paige Smathers. I live in Salt Lake, and I'm a registered dietitian, and I'm in private practice. So,
registered dietitian. What's the significance of that?
So it's registered dietitian nutritionist is another way of saying it. Basically, I'm trained in nutrition therapy, and I provide eating disorder nutrition therapy as well as like chronic dieting, family feeding dynamics, various medical conditions. And really the big question a lot of people like to ask is, you know, what's the difference between that and a nutritionist? And
just going to ask that.
Yeah. So a nutritionist is actually not a regulated term. So anyone can call themselves that, and anyone can create some type of like credentialing program that then says like, oh, now you're a certified nutritionist or whatever. So it doesn't have like a credentialing body that governs the ethics or the licensure or anything like that. Whereas registered dietitian is a term that you're only allowed to use if you do certain schoolwork in college and have a certain major and then pass a licensing exam and then also do a year-long internship as well. So,
all right. So you're the former, the latter. Sorry, you're the latter. You've got the degree, you've got the licensing.
Yeah.
All the credentials that go with it. So let me do an analogy. It'd be maybe equivalent to, say, a clinical psychologist, which has a certain criterion, and like a life coach, for example. Just anyone could be.
That's
fair?
That's pretty similar. And yeah, like I'm not a huge fan of like coaching, although people like to use that word so that they can like do their work across state lines. But yeah, like it's very similar. It's like
sure.
Coach, what does that even mean? Versus psychologist has a very specific meaning. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And we found you because you presented at Sunstone, what, June of 2017? Is that right?
Yeah. Was it June?
June, July, late July. Well, the summer, Salt Lake Sunstone. Yeah. Summer 2017.
And I hung out with Randy for a long time and chatted with him and Glenn and told him, you know, just chatted with them about how much I love the podcast. So that's, that's
awesome. Yeah. And you are a podcaster yourself.
Yeah, I am.
Tell us about your podcast.
So my podcast is called Nutrition Matters Podcast. And I talk all about just kind of what I like to say, like what really matters in nutrition and health. And so we explore different topics in those categories and focusing a lot on intuitive eating, honoring your body, rejecting dieting, that type of thing.
Yeah. And that's a lot of the stuff I want to get into with our episode, kind of introduce that concept. But you also do a lot of interviews with other dietitians and people that have expertise in that whole milieu. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So lots of other professionals, some psychologists, therapists, dietitians, and then just some lay people that I think have interesting stories. So, yeah.
Yeah. What are a couple of, what you think are some of the more, I guess, interesting episodes that you've had, just to kind of give a taste of some of the range that you have?
Well, so the listening audience might actually already be familiar with Beauty Redefined. Their work, I have a podcast coming out tomorrow, so we're recording the day before that comes out. But that one I anticipate will be really popular. Beauty Redefined is a nonprofit owned by two twins who are actually Mormon. And they both have PhDs, and they've studied media literacy and body image, and they have really fascinating research to share about body image resilience. So that one's awesome. A couple other really popular episodes. I'm not going to know what the numbers are, but there's one where I talk about how to care about your eating without caring too much. That's a popular one. You're putting me on the spot. If I can remember.
I particularly like the ones on kids.
Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. Those are super popular. Lots about raising intuitive eaters. I have a part one and part two for that. It's just such a paradigm shift from kind of how we think we need to be with food.
And the thing that I find, I guess, so almost daunting of interviewing you, Paige, and why maybe your other stuff hasn't been published yet is because as I think about eating, it's kind of similar to the work that I do when it comes to dealing with kids in particular and dealing with abuse, is that it just seems to affect and touch so many aspects of individuals' lives, and it has collateral effects beyond just I guess the topic at hand. So if I'm talking about child sexual abuse, we could dovetail into you know, anxiety, eating disorders, trust issues, intimacy issues. I mean, it starts to touch a lot of things. And I found a lot of parallels, I found that. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah. Like, I got into this work because I thought I was going to like save the world and teach them about nutrition. And then I realized, oh, wait, this is everything. This touches every single aspect of life. And when your relationship with food is challenging, or your relationship with your body is chaotic and dysfunctional, it affects literally every part of your life. And so the work I do really can kind of seem sort of like superficial, like, oh, let's talk about carbs, fats, and proteins. But really, when you get into it, it's like such meaningful work that can be a source of so much confidence and strength in other areas as you develop those strengths with food, you know?
Right. You know, I've been kind of aware of other people's jobs a lot more recently. Maybe that's a reflection on me looking for another job. I don't know, but we just had an issue with our house that caused almost a complete rebuild. And I was just really in awe of the craftsmen that were here kind of doing tile work and painting and watching, you know, the care that they took into their job, but then the impact that it had on us in our life. They were a part of our home, and it just gave me a real appreciation for, you know, for these guys who were laying tile and painting and building things here. And that may be apropos of nothing, but, we certainly have this effect, this lattice that impacts a lot of different aspects of people's lives with the things that we do. And you are right there just in the middle of a lot of shit.
A lot of shit. Yeah. No, really. And like, and all of my clients will cry and apologize as they're like taking a million tissues. And it's like, well, there's a reason there's tissues there. This is super emotional stuff to talk about. And yeah, like it's not something, and it's often not even somewhere or a topic that you feel like you can even share with people because A, it's so normalized and glamour, normalized. Is that a word? Yeah, that sounded weird saying that.
I think so.
And glamorized.
We'll normalize, normalize.
Normalize. It's so even glamorized, like struggling with food and having this like really chaotic pendulum swinging type relationship with food. And so even sometimes with their therapists who aren't necessarily trained about disordered eating and the dieting cycle and diet culture, it can even be tough to know how to talk about these things, even with trusted professionals, because not everybody's sensitized to, you know, all of these issues. So for some people, this is like the first time they're really expressing some of these things and some of these concerns.
How connected to traumas do you see food and food related issues?
Oh, huge, huge. It's actually pretty rare for me to, you know, do my assessment and ask a bunch of questions and try to really get to know a person and not uncover some type of trauma that has happened that's caused some type of dysfunction around food. And that's not to say like everybody who struggles has some type of like, you know, sexual assault history or something like that. But you know, a lot of bullying, that's a big one about weight. So a lot of this ties into concerns about weight. And so, you know, very much so. I really, really see that a ton. And again, no one ever told me in school, like, hey, you're going to be holding space for people who have like gone through real traumas, you know?
Right. Well, and
I'm sure you're the same, right?
Well, I am, but I want to make this about me because if you recall, as we started talking, I was experiencing an awareness the last couple of times we started talking.
Yeah.
I experienced some awareness for the first time of some of the traumas that I experienced as a kid with food. And it was simply things that in you discussing things generally allowed me to kind of recognize in my own, my own awareness, right? It kind of just awakened it to me. And I kind of had my own little therapy session unbeknownst to me, listening to Paige just talk about the work that she does, the work that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So, that's awesome.
So both thank you and thank you, right?
Well, right so, back at you. Right.
Unexpected therapy sessions, but
that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it was really, it was interesting. And it's again, why the episodes didn't get published, because I was still wrapping my head around
a lot
of those things. And it helped me crystallize, well, a philosophy that I've kind of come up with that I wanted to pitch to you and see what you think.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
So it was kind of born from so the presentation I did at Sunstone, this is going to be basically a 3-minute version of it, okay, was titled How Joseph Smith Taught Me to Heal from Sexual Abuse. Okay. But a better title that I developed as I did my presentation was what the first vision taught me about trauma.
Mm.
And then I went a little further because I think what it was actually is what the universe taught me about myself. So what I come to, and again, in many ways, our conversations have kind of were the beginnings of spawning this off, is the idea that Joseph Smith, when he had the first vision, he came away with a couple concepts. God is real. The creeds are an abomination, and a person can get revelation directly from God. And I put just a slightly different spin on that to say, you know, the universe exists, consciousness exists, and we should try to learn as much as we can about how the real world works. Right? That's the God is real. The second one is creeds are an abomination. There should be no creeds. There should be no dogmas. That is, we should reject you should-isms as it applies to other people. And then the Related to that is to follow your intuition, which worded another way is trust yourself, which really worded another way is love yourself. Then the last one that I come to is be connected. Find other people that can hold these views, that can help facilitate these things within you. That's my life philosophy generally. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on that, first of all, and how that relates to what you do.
Ooh, those are awesome. And I totally agree. It really resonates with me a ton. The big thing that stood out to me just in context and in terms of what I do for work is the idea of like rejecting dogma. I think mm-hmm. that's huge. And that's...
Go on.
So my talk at Sunstone was about that exact thing, that like the term dieting dogma was even in the title of my presentation. So I think that, you know, religion can be reincarnated in diet and food and healthism and wellness and all of that. And it can even be reincarnated in rejecting dieting, right? So there's this whole, some people don't know about this whole dynamic, but let me just take a zoomed out perspective really quick.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. Go.
Okay. So there's, you know, there's this big cultural and social push to diet, to eat well, which I don't think are the same things, but a lot of people do. To diet, to restrict, to lose weight, to only eat certain foods, all that stuff. And then there's this whole cohort of people who are realizing how much damage that's causing in people, in eating disorders, also in just chaotic relationships with food. And like we said, food touches every aspect of your life. So, and so there's this whole cohort of people who are saying diets are the worst thing ever. Reject them completely. Don't do anything like you used to do when you were dieting. Just eat whatever you want, whenever you want. And so many of my clients come to me and they've been on both sides and they're like, I feel like I'm not being a good intuitive eater because I'm not rejecting dieting well enough. Or I feel like I'm not being a good enough dieter because I'm not being able to follow all the rules. And that is all dogma, right? Like you're giving away your authority to someone else to tell you what to do, which is
say that again. Say that again.
You're giving away your authority to someone else and relying on them to tell you what to do.
Right.
And it's like, for me, here's how I think about it. For me personally, like I did that with religion. And I fought so hard to get my authority back. I'll never give that away again, ever, you know, whether that's about food or about how I run my business or about how I talk to clients or about how I, you know, parent or anything. It's like, no, you don't have the answer for me. And the answer for me is something only I can know. And you just have to trust that I'm paying attention to that and doing the best I can with what's right for me. Mm. So this idea of dogma is like, I recognize, so in the world I'm in nutrition, we are very concerned about not triggering people and saying the right things and being sensitive and being aware of being, you know, using correct terms. And I'm all for all that stuff. But at the same time, sometimes I'm like, hey guys, I have religious trauma, you know, and yeah. You doing all of this talk about gaining converts to this method or evangelizing your point of view or... I mean, oh, the religious undertones in some of the groups that I run in, I'm just like, I can't, you know, like I fundamentally cannot do that. So that was a long
response. No, that was fantastic. And your appeal to self-authority is you almost quoted something that I said the other day, which is, I won't give away my personal authority to anyone else ever again.
Totally.
I mean, that's just nails. Oh shoot. I lost something there. Always comes back to me.
dogma?
No, let me pose this to you. Cause you said okay. Something there that is very synonymous with something that I've been saying as well lately, which is, you know, the idea that once you put language to something, that creates religion. And maybe more specifically, is the more rigid the language, the more rigid the dogma. Rather than providing a framework and allowing a concept to advance, we get caught up into rigid definitions. This is the legalistic, well, that word actually means this, and it's my application of this word. And I've been really thinking recently about how limiting language is, talking about things that matter, especially when first I have to come up with the right expression from what I'm feeling in my heart, connection between heart and head. And then I put it out there, and then I'm relying on a translation and an interpretation from that person, taking it into their head and heart.
Which is the hard thing about podcasting, right?
Yeah.
Because you're kind of on the spot and talking and just being imperfect with your language, but then people on the other side can choose to kind of hear what they want to hear.
Absolutely.
What I run into.
Especially in a podcast form when it is only language. And you have a tough time, you know, especially to take away expression. Hopefully they feel that you can express authenticity, but not always, right? I've always found that communication, language is a poor form of communication. One of the things that I've been trying to do lately is communicate with, it sounds so silly, but with a hug, you know,
that doesn't sound silly. I love that.
That sounds silly for me, but,
you know what? Okay. I have to tell you, the other week, my cousin came over and so we left the church a few years ago, and I never know what kind of reaction I'm going to get from people who are still in. Right. So it's always this like anxious thing. And she came over and she gave me the biggest hug after, you know, hi. And that was it. That's all she said. And then she just communicated like, I love you. I don't care. It's no big deal. And it was like all very clear in a hug. So I know exactly what you mean. Like that's a big deal.
It's been helpful. Music has been another one. I've been responding to texts with songs, especially challenging texts where the relationship is a little complicated. So that's, it's been fairly effective so far.
You're so artsy.
Very artsy. I'm embracing my woo.
I love it.
So I want to kind of get into the nuts and bolts. This philosophy that I've presented so far, which I think to a lot of people is just going to sound like, yeah, no shit. Everybody has that philosophy, except do we?
No. So like, here's the thing though, again, language, like you feel this like, oh, this all makes so much sense. And this is my conviction. And this is where my heart is. And then you're like, here, let me explain it to you. And it's like, it just never comes out quite the same way as it feels, you know, it's like the nature of trying to describe that type of thing.
It's also a form. The more language you put to it, the more proselyting that's being done. And sometimes I wonder if we have confidence in the message, confidence in the principles, that we let the concept speak for itself. And
what's Joseph Smith quote?
teach correct principles.
Yeah.
He was very close on a lot of things.
You know what? I totally see what you mean by that. And I really like that.
Does that resonate with you and in what you do?
Oh my, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How's that?
So, I mean, you can get so complicated in the black and white of these things. And I think here's how I see our progression. When you realize that there's more to life than like being on a diet or restricting or hating your body or whatever's going on for you, you kind of maybe do, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this, but my opinion is like, you do kind of a lot of times need to sort of adopt some black and white rules where it's like, no, I'm not allowed to exercise 4 hours a day anymore. That's not appropriate. And so I'm going to hold myself to this amount of time, or I'm not allowed to, you know, eat 8 donuts. I'm going to hold myself to this amount or whatever. Like you might need some black and white rules to work through a real thing.
Can I maybe put a spin on that?
Yeah, please.
See if I can take what you've said, cause it spawned an idea, which is, maybe if we could present the differences between dogmas and a framework.
Mm-hmm.
A framework that has fluidity, individualization, or an allowance for individualization versus a rigidity of dogma, of defined, definite, I guess, rules. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So here's what I think about that. It's tricky to talk to a group of people and provide a framework that works for every person. And here's why. Especially with nutrition, right? There are some people who need to hear, like, who cares? Just eat a donut, you know? But then there are some people who need to hear, hey, all those donuts you're eating, not a good idea, right? So it's like there's different extremes that we're working with. People who are like food obsessed and people who need to chill out about food. And then people who kind of don't care enough and might need to hear messages of like, hey, healthy eating isn't out of your reach and you can make improvement. It doesn't need to be, you know?
So this is what really resonates with me is with my job and specifically as it relates to understanding child sexual abuse, trauma, child trauma. One of the things that we talk about is there is kind of a general, there are some behaviors that we can understand, but each circumstance is individual. And so what I sometimes wonder, one of the things that I am contemplating is if we can present how the real world works and what the real world looks in general terms and provide enough variability and just kind of what you did. Here are, there are no rules, there are no dogmas, but you know, for some people, let me get specifics. Okay. For some kids, when they're sexually abused, they are distracted at school, right? Other kids, laser focus. That is their distraction from the trauma.
Right.
If I tell that to people, that makes intuitive sense. Right. Oh, I could see both of those completely opposite things working or being a reality for each of those children. Right. I wonder if in a group setting, if we present all of those as viable realities, as legitimate realities, as realities that we all accept as true, if the kid who experienced the one will really pick up on that and resonate with them because they know for them that's how it was, or even maybe that's how it would be versus the other person there. So I wonder if by presenting to a group that there are no dogmas, and for some people, having no donuts is just something they have to do. For other people, they have to have that available. If the person that you're communicating to, either in a podcast, in a group, or something else, will really go up and grab that, because you've just given them the permission to have confidence in themselves.
Okay. Permission is the framework, right? So permission to explore what works for you. Permission to eat and move your body and take care of yourself in a way that's right for you. Because so much of the framework that we approach food in is shoulds and dogma and shouldn'ts and can't and morality even around food, right? So like good, bad, right, wrong, guilty, sinful. I mean, all of those words come up around food. So the typical framework in which a person approaches food is very much steeped in religious undertones. And so if you...
Worthiness as well.
Oh, for sure. I mean, worthiness. So here's how you trace it back, right? Good and bad foods equal, right? If I eat too many bad foods, I'm just using this as an example. If I eat too many bad foods, then I will gain weight. And if I gain weight, then I will automatically not be able to have the things I want in my life. Cause that's what we're sold in.
Right. This is the common myth that you're fighting against and trying to break down.
Exactly. And so, and then if nobody loves me, then I'm not worthy. And it all, I mean, food, if you trace it back far enough, it comes down to worthiness for sure. And so I think the fundamental shift in the paradigm and in the framework, and you asked about podcast episodes, I actually have an entire one about this idea of permission. Like what permission seems scary with food. Cause like, oh, if I give myself permission, what would I do? Well, really it opens up your mind to be able to ask yourself the right questions. Because you're not asking yourself, huh, do I want this? Does it sound good? Am I hungry? Will it satisfy me? You're not asking those questions when you're wrapped up in, should I do this? Should I not? It's just compulsive eating because you can't even think through those questions, right? So permission opens up the ability to like ask yourself what you need to be asking yourself to be able to make decisions that are ultimately in your best interest.
As you've been saying that about permission, there's another concept that's been in my mind lately, especially as it relates to trauma, and really not just trauma, but as a human condition. And it's something that my wife and I just talked about this weekend. And I'm going to disclose some things here. But okay. We got into a fight. We got into an argument. I can yell. I have a temper. So that unfortunate characteristic manifested itself. And, a couple of days later, we were talking about it. And she was, telling me how, even though you do that, I would rather you not, but I love you regardless. And I want you to know that when you do that, you, instead of beating yourself up, I want you to know that I love you. And so what I responded to her was with, I accept that, but I need you to understand that when you fall short, I love you just the way you love me with my flaws. And 21 years, she'd never heard it like that before. More importantly, she'd never felt it like that before, because she was feeling love for a flawed human, me. And I tried to redirect that so that she would feel love for a flawed human, her. Mm. And I was able, I think, to switch that external love for me to an internal love for her. And for me, that's a lot of what you're talking about, is not just giving people forgiveness, but allowing them, or permission, allowing them to be okay with the flaws, okay with the imperfections, okay with navigating through their diet with awkwardness and trying things out and failing things here and seeing what works and sometimes not, and being okay with themselves through that process. What do you think about that?
That is amazing. And that's actually what you were just saying really reminded me of something I tell clients. So if you don't mind, I'll
please share that
with you. Okay. So I always, it's tough for me to answer the ultimate question people want to know from a dietitian, right? So people want to know,
what's that?
What should I eat?
Yeah.
It's like,
just give me a list, right?
Yeah, exactly. Again, like dogma, black and white. Tell me exactly what to do.
Yeah, be my prophet, essentially.
Exactly. And I'm like, woo, I got major prophet issues. But what I tell them is, it's really problematic for me to be prescriptive about what you eat, because what you need to eat one day might vary and differ on another day. And what you eat is probably very different from what I eat, which is different from every single other client I work with. And so rather than me giving you a list of do's and don'ts, let's talk about like, how would you feed someone you love, right? How would you take care of someone who you really care about? And so often it's pretty easy. It's like, well, I would offer a wide variety of foods. I would probably have kind of scheduled regular meals so that they would know when they're coming. I would probably tell them no if they wanted to eat 10 minutes before it was time to eat, because I would just say, hey, like dinner's coming, right? So we would have what I would call that is some gentle kind of like boundaries, maybe guidelines.
Framework.
Framework. Yeah, to use your terminology, I like that. So some gentle framework to work with. But what it also really implies is so much compassion and such a different paradigm in how we typically approach ourselves with food. Typically it's, well, you have to eat that so you lose weight, or you can't eat that because that will make you gain weight, or whatever we say, or that's bad for your health. But why do we offer vegetables to our kids? Well, it's not because we're saying, oh, you're so overweight, so you need to eat this food. It's no, I want you to eat this food because it makes you feel good. And it's important for you to like lots of different foods. So we offer those things to our kids from that framework of love. And then also when a child makes a mistake about food, like let's say they eat all the Halloween candy and they come to you and they have a stomach ache and they're super sad. you know, the last thing you do is yell at your child and say, how dare you eat that? You're such a, you know, gross pig for eating all that food. Like, you'd never yell at them and say that. You'd say, well, let's sit on my lap. I'm going to hug you. And I'm going to tell you, I'm so sorry that your stomach hurts. But then I'm also going to say, why did that happen? How can we learn? How can we do better next time? And the thing is, we don't do any of that with ourselves. You know, we just eat whenever we feel like it. We don't eat vegetables when we're in the mode where we're like, screw diets, or we only eat vegetables when we're trying to diet. And when we make a mistake, quote unquote, with our eating, we reprimand ourselves and expect that to work. Well, it never would work for someone we love. Why do we do it to ourselves? And so sometimes we get to the point where in session, we'll realize together, like, wow, there's some real like self-loathing going on. Like, let's talk to a therapist about that stuff, you know, because so much of how we feed ourselves is dependent on how we feel about ourselves, you know?
And I mean, I was thinking as you were talking about feeding oneself nourishly, but also feeding oneself with certain, you know, emotionally, and those emotional needs and even physical needs of whether it be physical touch and those things. And we do the same thing of neglecting our needs and in some cases recognizing those things, those people that we need to avoid for our own emotional health, and finding where that balance is of, okay, this is a person I have to deal with because of whatever circumstances, but I'm going to pick my spots of how and when to deal with that person. So for maybe people, that's, you know, a particular type of food that they can navigate with in a more healthy way. And I'm certainly seeing that in my own life and other people that I love is that, anyway, what are your thoughts on that? Am I just spitting nonsense?
No, you're not at all. That makes total sense to me. And the thing is, you're allowed to do what you need to do. And it's okay if it looks different from someone else. Like there are some clients who legitimately need to just take such a break from the pendulum swing of dieting that they just say, like, I'm just going to eat whatever. And I'm just not going to think about any of this stuff for a while. And I'm just going to kind of let it flow. And slowly they can kind of come back to like, okay, what makes my body feel good? How can I apply some gentle nutrition? How can I move my body in a way that feels good? Right. So there's no right or wrong with this. It's all about what's right or wrong for you. And that's going to look different person to person.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, but it does feel all the stuff that we're talking about, both me from a trauma standpoint and you from a nutritional standpoint, which, I mean, I didn't realize why you resonated so much with me, but it was because these connections that I made with I guess what I'd consider my best topic, the thing that I'm a national expert on.
Yeah.
But it helped tweak it a little bit, but it feels like an advanced move. And I think the challenge becomes, and I'll tell you, I feel like I've been able to apply this to a degree as it relates to my own trauma, as I've recognized that. But the goal I have, and I think the goal that you have, is how to apply, how to help others apply that in themselves. So I want to spend a few minutes kind of talking about the actual application of whether it be intuitive eating or intuitive healing. I'm going to call what I'd like to do. What do you see as the obstacles to people being comfortable following their own intuition or listening to? Let me ask this first. If you had to kind of describe what intuition is as it relates to the stuff that you do, how would you describe it?
Okay. So here's how I describe it. We only need to do a very few things to stay alive as a human, right? We need to breathe. We need to pee. We need to poop. We need to sleep. We need to stay warm. What else? We need
sex.
To drink water, sex. Well, sex is, yeah, it's there, but it's like a higher need if you're not getting those things, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
see where I jumped to? I'm like, sex, sex.
Sex. Yeah. You have to mention sex. Don't forget that.
I mean, come on.
So when I think about, you know, our breathing. You and I have been talking this whole time. Neither one of us have probably thought about breathing at all, but it just happens, right? Yeah. Now, if someone told you, hey, you can't breathe too often, only, you know, X amount of times per day. Well, if someone created an anxiety in you about how much you're supposed to breathe or created a dogma about that, you develop dysfunctional breathing. If someone told you, you know, something like similar with sleep, you would develop dysfunction with sleep. So we tell each other all these rules, not just one, millions, infinite rules about nutrition. And we're like, why am I so dysfunctional? Well, it's something that we are built to do. And our bodies are programmed or evolved, actually, like using the word evolved better. It depends on who I'm talking to. Right. Our bodies have evolved to force us to do the things that stay alive if we choose to not do them. So if we choose to not breathe, you can only do that for so long, right? And then your brain, that's all you can think about. And then you finally gasp for air. If you choose to not sleep, eventually you'll pass out. If you choose to not pee, eventually you'll pee your pants, right? So if you choose to not eat through intentional restriction or some crazy diet or starvation, you will be super motivated to find food because that's what your body has evolved to do to keep you alive. And so that's...
Sorry, can I just... That, to me, if I could maybe expound on that just a minute.
Please.
To me, that takes a lot of the pressure away, because if I accept that, evolutionary background, then most of the work has been done because I exist and because my DNA is the way it is. And so maybe I don't have to have confidence in my will or, my willpower, but maybe I could instead try to tap in to my confidence in evolution and in DNA and the fact that I want to live. I want to live.
And
that seems like it takes it away from a psychological thing to a biological thing. And that maybe that shift in perception could help remove some of those psychological obstacles that we think are there, or at least mitigate them somewhat.
Okay. So I relate this to having a baby, right? Like I was so petrified of having a human being come out of my body. Like, whoa, that is so scary. But the thought that gave me courage and strength in those two times that I was preparing for having a child, I just remembered like my body's meant for this. Like my ancestors and my DNA are all like conspiring within my body to like make this happen. So I need to just trust that. And the same is true with food. You know,
I love the word conspire.
Yeah.
By the way, because sometimes I think it's the universe through evolution and whatever means is certainly conspiring if we allow it, if we tap in to that and to our own bodies.
Oh, our bodies are made to eat food, you know, like it's just that simple. And if you watch a newborn baby or a young child eat, you know, they are perfect examples of what we're trying to work on as adults. And so it's not necessarily learning something new. It's coming back to something we already know inside of us. Right. And so how this relates to me with my own journey in like the whole church thing is I gave away my power, you know, over and over again, like, oh, well that I don't agree with that, but I'll just go along with it. Cause whatever. And just on and on with that type of thing. And when you leave the church, you leave your whole framework and you have to rebuild it piece by piece. And you realize like, I'm never, like we said earlier, like I'm never giving away that authority ever again. And I am pretty damn powerful and wise and amazing if I just take the time to like learn about myself and learn about what works. And food is no different.
And that's why where I come back to a lack of trust and a lack of self-love is it's a foundational problem for trusting one's intuition. It's why I think we see a lot of, crowdsourcing for, what should I do with my kid? What should I do with this scenario? That comes from a place of doubt, self-doubt, and thinking that somebody else has the answer. Because you know they're older, they have kids that are maybe that age. They've gone through it before, and that could be a good, again, framework to take from. But then to internalize and say, well, what is does that seem to work for what I know about me, my child, my life, my circumstances? So one of the things I've been kind of playing with is this idea of kind of the meaning of life, right? And the meaning of life.
Just the meaning of life.
That's it. Just some small, trite, banal concepts like the meaning of life. If you accept that the first grove, what was taken from the grove, from the first vision, the universe exists. My goal is to learn as much as I can about how the real world works, that it starts from my perception, right? And that, that's the universe of kind of what I know. But at some point, you hopefully get to know what you don't know and realize is there is other things out there that I just don't know. And I think it's those times when you seek other people's input, right? Be connected, see what other people might provide. But it's so critical to understand that just like your perception is here, that person's perception also may be just at, 20% or whatever that angle is, and that they don't have the same perception, experiences, circumstances that you have. And so their experience or their view on things may not be as applicable as you might originally think, because things that are apparently similar sometimes couldn't be more different. So again, that not having, I guess, overconfidence in other people and underconfidence in ourselves. And I think both of those things contribute to a lot of destructive cycles.
Oh, yes. And also, like, that's the big thing I'm battling in my office all the time is my style is very much like, wait a minute, don't give your authority to me. Like, no, you're your own, you're your own guru when it comes to this. You know your body. I'm just going to help ask questions and help you figure out what you need to do. But the thing that, and this is kind of going back to one of your questions earlier, like people want to just know what to do. And I wonder, because I live in Salt Lake, a lot of my clients are Mormon, a lot of them aren't. But I wonder if there is just sort of this, I wonder if I practiced in my hometown of like San Jose, California, I wonder, would I have the same barriers come up with, no, just tell me exactly what to do. I don't know. I wonder if that's a Mormon thing or not.
I think it's a human condition.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of the things that I believe pretty strongly is it's something you said earlier, and it relates to a presentation I'm going to do tomorrow I'm doing it on trauma and on sexual abuse, and I'm trying to provide some educational information, but also some very specific strategies to help helping to develop a child's identity to prevent, expose, and heal abuse, heal trauma. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I have come to believe very strongly based on my interactions with kids. And one of the things that I've done in my job for over 10 years is to talk to kids one-on-one about some of the worst things that ever happened to them, trying to find out how they, something that they experienced that they don't want to talk about. So as a result of that, I went to some very fairly involved training to be a forensic interviewer in order to use this very specific technique, which is meant to get kids communicating. Kids communicating about the way they've interpreted their world. And what I've learned in talking to kids as little as 3 and 4 is they are very, very good at both navigating, interpreting, and explaining their world. And what we don't do, or maybe what we do, is we suppress that very early. Now, this is a preview into some of the things that I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, which is we do that, I think, by viewing kids not as their own identity, but as extensions of so many different things. Mm. It's an extension of a parent, extension of both parents, an extension of the family, an extension of the church, an extension of the team, an extension of the school, an extension of the neighborhood, the community, the country, all these things. We make these kids... We force these so many different uh, false identities on, well, not false identities. We give them so many different labels that we force on them that we don't allow them to just develop their own identity as an individual. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think that that is huge. And that comes down to like, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but just, I've been thinking about this a lot just with my own kids, just no autonomy, you know, in our world where the parents just get so mad at each other if a kid is like walking across the street by themselves, or if the, you know, like I remember as a kid, I would play outside all day. My parents didn't even know really where I was. It was just kind of what we did. And I feel like there's such a shift with like kids being able to make their own decisions, have some autonomy, be able to kind of be themselves, discover what their identity is versus now. It seems like it really is kind of helicoptering. And I wonder how much that affects our child, you know?
And you know, I think those of us that were brought up in a religion, we were told how to think, this is true, rather than giving the child a space to navigate their world, rely on their evolutionary instincts to kind of figure out and interpret their world, give them a safe net with which to operate, but to allow them to expand rather than just to shoot off on one specific course that was set for them.
Kids are so wise. Can I tell you a little story about my,
yeah.
So on Saturday, my 5-year-old and I were driving together and she said, "Mom, what's baptism?" And she's been asking about Jesus because of Easter and all that. And you know, we just say, "Well, what do you think? Here's what it is. What do you think about that?" Like she says about Jesus and the resurrection. She says, "Well, that sounds a little weird. I don't think that really happened," you know? And it's so fascinating to just not tell a child what to think, but just to say, here are the facts of what people believe, or here's the story. What do you think about that? And her intuition and her experience, her like observation of the world so far in 5+ years is, I don't buy that. And don't you remember being a kid and thinking that at church? At least I did. Like,
sure.
Wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. What is that about? And then you go home and ask your parents and you're like, okay, everyone seems to think this is legit, so I'll go ahead and go along with it, you know?
Yeah. And I think, well, I'm interested in this idea of allowing kids their own intuition as it relates to food. And maybe some of the things that are done traditionally that you found have negative effects down the road.
Yeah, this is a huge topic, but you know, in general, here's how I would summarize it. Kids are very good at honoring hunger and fullness cues. And in the end, that's really what we need to do to take good care of our bodies. We need to eat when we're hungry and we need to stop when we're full. It's pretty much that simple. And kids, it's not complicated, right? So they don't have all this morality around food. They don't have, oh, a cookie is bad, but broccoli is good. It's just, it is what it is. So parents really well-meaning, but they'll say, eat your broccoli, it's so good for you. And they think that that's motivating. But really what that does to a child is the people pleaser will eat it just to please you. But the non people pleaser child will say, screw you, like I'm not eating that. And then now you've made it about a battle about who's going to win rather than what they're actually eating. So,
and all I'm seeing now is traumas happening
absolutely.
To kids.
Absolutely. And trauma at the table is a thing. Like maybe we should write a book, you and me, trauma at the table, because you know, so often someone will say, well, I hate eating dinner. I hate sitting down with the family. And I'll be like, well, why? And then they're like, well, my dad used to yell at us during dinner, or, you know, they have some reason why. And it's like, it can get in the way of being able to like feed yourself appropriately. But what I was going to say about the kids and eating is the best way to do it is to know what your jobs are as the parent and what their jobs are as the kid. And your job as the parent is to provide the food, so the what, and to provide it at certain parts of the day, so the when, right? So regular scheduled meals and snacks.
The framework.
And then the child, their job.
I do my hands like I'm in this tube, like providing this both ceiling and net around these kids.
I love
you like
it.
That?
I
you
love
like
it.
That idea, that concept?
Yeah. some diagrams yeah. are coming to mind. I love it. So, and then the kid's job, and this can be scary for parents, but again, permission is big, right? So the kid's job is if they eat at all, first of all, and then how much. And it's amazing what happens. Just, I'll just share a story today at lunch. I was eating with my three-year-old, and I really try to do this idea of putting food on their plate that's well-balanced, and then they get to choose what to eat. I put a quesadilla with some meat on it for her starch and protein, and then I added some little peppers on my three-year-old's plate. And she said, I don't want those. And I said, okay, well, they're going to just stay on your plate and you can just choose, you know, whether or not you eat them. It's your choice. And she knows that so much. Like, it's not a battle of who's in charge. She knows that that's true. It's really her choice. And sometimes she refuses, but today she ended up eating three little peppers because it wasn't a thing. Right.
Yeah.
And she really knows no difference between a bell pepper and a cookie. Like, it's not a thing for her. And I hope that lasts as long as possible because it's so precious and it's so fun to see yeah. how kids really do make great choices about food and about how much and about balance when it's not this power struggle between parents and kids.
Now, I know that a lot of listeners are just going to be like, yeah, bullshit. Right. But what maybe fair. I want to do is put a pin in this and explore this idea a little with a little more detail on maybe later episodes, if you're willing to do that.
Sure. And they can also check out the podcast. I mean, there's a reason why there's books written about this and there's hours and hours of podcasts about this. This is not simple. And just like a lot of different approaches or paradigms, at first glance, you can be like, oh, that doesn't make sense. Or like, that seems crazy. But really, if you look into the research supporting this, I mean, this is not just like something someone dreamed up. This is like backed up by a very significant body of literature too. Yeah.
I like mansplaining it though. It's fun.
Yeah, please mansplain. Actually, because I'm a.
It's really idiot splaining, is what I think it is. Oh, it's idiots really can't understand this. I get it. In full disclosure, I've adopted intuitive eating after you and I first talked, and in true Matt fashion, I completely rejected all gurus and really didn't. I listened to about three episodes and I really just started to try to
Good.
Be it and do it.
Good.
And it seems to work. We've tried to apply it to my family and especially my daughter. And, it's a work in process, but she's, we're trying to deprogram, 12 years of yeah. other, maybe different strategies in the past. And, one of the things that I really regret is the constant articulation of my own weight issues. I need to lose weight, need to go to the gym. I articulated those, and my wife articulated those for the better part of our marriage. And I'm really just now seeing that as my daughter's becoming 13. And so yeah. we're really fighting against that now. And that's part of also forgiving myself and recognizing those flaws and loving myself for those flaws and maybe being able to hopefully lean into those flaws and the things that I did rather than reject them and say, what can I now take from that and use as a jumping off point to help rather than hurt my daughter. And it's, so what we're doing is we're having open conversations about, my body issues and body issues generally, and just development and those things. Again, talking about how the real world works has helped my daughter navigate those issues.
And kids are so resilient. And I think you, as parents, we underestimate the power of like our words to them. If we just take the time to say, look, I thought I was doing the right thing, but turns out I've changed my mind. I think kids are like, oh, okay, cool. And I think they're able to kind of move on so much more than we are. And I'd also say for anyone listening with kids, one of the things that I would advise is to be really, open and welcoming to all different body types and to express that, because I think that a child doesn't need to be told themselves, you're fat, you need to lose weight. to develop body image issues, right? Obviously, there are parents who say that to their kids, but more often than not, it is just a general sort of level of, oh no, I know that my parents talk bad about certain types of bodies. And mm-hmm. if I ever have that body, my parents won't love me or my people won't love me. And so then they develop a fear, which then creates restriction, which then creates binging, which then creates all these cycles that lead to so much chaos.
Yeah. One of the things I think about with kids, the term that I try to consider is, are you dominating the kid? Right. And because I think a lot of people will say, well, look, I've got to provide some rules and some guidelines. How else will they learn? And what I ask people is, again, are you providing a framework? Are you providing guidelines or are you dominating? Mm-hmm. Are you forcing? You will eat this and this. You will, do that. Do you recommend to clients that they do the, you will finish your plate or, have some sort of a punishment, sit at the table till you finish the plate? Is that a topic that comes up?
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of similar to what you were saying earlier with the kid who focuses or the kid who's so distracted, right? It's kind of like, you know, your child. And so there might be situations where you just are like, no, like this, you just got to finish this, you know? And I'm not saying that that's absolutely terrible. And if you do that, it's the worst thing ever.
No creeds.
Right. But at the same time, in general, probably not a great idea, because what you do is you turn it into, we're battling, you and me, mom and me, kid. And therefore I have to hold my ground because I have to have the power and the control in this situation. And so
dominating, exactly,
when there's a framework of, I know when the next meal is coming, and I know that if I choose to skip this meal or barely eat, I'm going to suffer the consequences, which is hunger. And I know that my parents won't just, let me eat fruit snacks all day. Like I have to wait until, like legitimately have to wait until that next meal. A lot of times, it just takes a few times of a kid realizing you're serious about that and seeing that they don't really get a meal, get more food. They don't get to just say, well, I want to eat cookies instead of this dinner, so you'll give me cookies if I cry loud enough. They really see that, if I refuse to eat, I'm hungry until it's the next time to eat. So I might as well try to make it work within the meal that I've been served. But then again, there's little tricks you can do, like always serving something that you know your child will eat, right? Like you don't need to serve them like all the foods mixed together, super spicy. That's probably really challenging for a three-year-old. But if you can separate the foods, or if you can offer bread with it, or something that you know they'll take pretty easily, that can also be a really helpful strategy. And then they see you enjoying all the wide variety of foods, and really kids are motivated to be like us. So if they see us enjoying our vegetables and our salad or our rice or our salmon, they're gonna try that stuff.
Yeah, we have this little kind of borrowed grandbaby, what I call our gap grandkid, comes over a lot, and she's about right around two. And I started kind of introducing this idea to her mom as she was over here. And it was really fun to watch her take on a lot of different variety of foods and kind of know what she needed in the moment, rejecting cookies, eating cheese and grapes at this time, and then done, stop. And it was
fascinating.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to I say trust ourselves, but also we have such a hard time trusting our kids or the little ones. But that's kind of, to put a religious spin on it, that's what living by faith is faith in ourselves.
And you know what that made me think of too, is I think it's tough to trust our kids when we don't trust ourselves.
Yes.
And when we don't trust our own authority. And also I think it's tough to trust our kids when our kids are we see our kids as an extension of ourselves and not their own identities. Right.
Yes.
So that comes back to some of the stuff we've already said. If you recognize that this little five-year-old is her own person and I love her, but she's not me. And even though I might have struggles trusting myself, that doesn't mean she needs to have those struggles. I don't need to put that on her. You know,
I teased my wife, about, she has a train phobia, right? Just train tracks are, for some reason, she has some unresolved trauma from, well, not, I mean, it is, it's unresolved. She had knew like two people who in her, when she was a little kid, who died on, in a train accident. I mean, major stuff. And so, but I've watched as she's kind of injected that, that concern in, into our kids. And one of the things I say is, don't give them your traumas. Don't give them unnecessary traumas. And give them the healthy amount of traumas and let them find their own traumas, because they'll have them. We don't need to inject our own shit onto our kids.
It's so hard. I mean, you can, you like,
this is mindfulness, right? It's identifying it. It's, you have to be aware of it in your own self.
Yep.
But yeah, it's something to consider at least.
For sure. No, that's a really important thing, I think, for all parents to consider.
But to forgive yourself as parents when you do that, and when you're not perfect with your kids as well. I think there's this vicious cycle that happens of lack of self-love. And the more we do that with ourselves, the more we self-love ourselves, it starts becoming a different conversation. But really, the more that we do that in ourselves, the more easily I think we can facilitate that in other people. I feel that very, very strongly.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Yeah. All right. I want to wrap up a little bit here because we hit some good high points, but I want to talk about some, just a couple real general overviews, I guess, some specific strategies. If you just had to tell people real quick, here are some high end points of how you could approach every meal without it, without little tips. And I'm trying to set you up. I'm trying to give you a softball because you gave them to me and they were one of the greatest things. So if okay, you don't hit them, I'm going to say what you had told me previously, okay, which was helpful, but
okay, well, I'll
give you a shot first. Yeah. Read my mind here.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of mindfulness training is about that idea of like stimulus and then response. Right. And you're trying to create a gap, to be able to avoid that habitual reactivity that's just like stimulus response with zero mindfulness or awareness. So if you can approach a meal with that in mind, where you're just trying to create a little bit of a gap, trying to, before you reach for food, before you put food on your plate, maybe just think, how hungry do I feel? What do I feel like I need right now? What sounds good? What do I feel like will satisfy me? I think some of those questions are a really good way to create that gap. Some general guidelines are just, you know, you probably know more about nutrition than you give yourself credit for. A lot of the like bullshit, like bananas are bad for you, stuff you read on like, you know, the sidebar of Facebook, like avoid, you know, that's not good knowledge.
These three foods to avoid fat, exactly, you know, belly like, fat. Yeah.
Definitely not good to like go into that realm. And like side note, you could find a reason to feel afraid about any food you want with the internet. Right. So I think just trying to kind of come back to the basics. What do you feel is well balanced? You know, try to make sure that you feel nourished and satisfied at the end of every meal, where you don't feel like you're kind of still like, okay, where's the bread or where's the chocolate? If you're feeling that way at the end of the meal, you probably didn't get enough carbohydrate, you know? Mm-hmm. So getting a good balance of carbohydrate, fat, and protein, making sure that you're balancing your plate with various food groups and colors and textures and variety. Not just sitting down to a mountain of pasta. Not that pasta is bad. It's just pasta on its own isn't going to satisfy you or nourish you to the same degree as pasta and some type of protein and maybe a nice salad or something like that.
I was listening to a, well, before I get there, I should go where the flow takes me. I was, you nailed on, I think three of them. I'm going to come back to one or two of them because they've helped me so much and maybe they'll help other people, but this came from you. So it's not my own stuff. But one of the things that I was listening to, I think it was the Under the Skin podcast with Russell Brand, and they're having a conversation of starvation versus obesity problems. And he made the point that, you know, they're really the, you know, two sides of the same coin, which are people are being underserviced. You know, these are still nutritional problems, you know, with obesity also being one of being underserviced. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I only see a small group of people in my actual office, but I've talked to hundreds of people throughout the years about what they eat and about what their habits are like and about how they approach food. And I'll tell you what, most of my beliefs or narratives I'd been taught about people in larger bodies have been blown out of the water. You know, most people are actively trying their darndest to get out of their situation that they're in because there is so much oppression and so much stigma living in a larger body. So like, I do agree that there is an under service perhaps, but I would probably spin it to, we are pushing that everybody needs to look a certain way to be healthy. Mm. And really there's more to health than the way that we look, and we can be healthy. We can pursue healthy habits no matter what our body looks like. And we can trust that our body will be the exact right size and shape for our body if we take good care of it. And I think if our culture somehow magically shifted to that, I think that it would be a whole lot better place to live for everybody, you know, because this fat phobia that we have going on is not servicing anybody. And we have these narratives about people that just aren't true, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's good stuff. So the questions you gave me one time was what do I feel like? And then after it's on your plate, saying, will this satisfy me? Does this, what I've kind of got here, does this seem satisfying? Those two kind of questions beforehand forced me into really mentally evaluating, is that what I want? And I found that it has reduced the mindless eating, that I'm trying to find the thing that scratches that itch. And then when I don't, I go find another thing that scratches that itch and it doesn't. I'm more inclined to either not or take a bite and not continue on that path. And then when I indulge, it is so satisfying.
Yeah,
it
is so much more fun.
Yes.
Yeah.
My now every once in a while maple bar, which I just love a good Bosa donut maple bar. the times when I do have it, I'll say this, it is so satisfying because it really is guilt-free because of you.
Oh my goodness. And guilt has no place with food. Okay. It doesn't. Like, if you stole the food, you're allowed to feel guilty, but you're not like food.
Unless you're
not
Jean Valjean. Come on.
Exactly. Like, food is not a moral issue, right? So like, you're not a bad person for eating a donut and you're not a good person for eating a salad. Those are just, it's not, life is not that simple. Right. So and the crazy thing about this that you're hitting on is the more you let go of shoulds and shouldn'ts, and you just go with what feels right to you, the more you're actually able to enjoy food, which pleasure and enjoyment is key to health, right? Like, we are supposed to indulge and feel pleasure from food. And when we do, it helps us know when it's time to stop, because at some point food stops being as pleasurable. And that's one of the signs that you've had enough, versus if you're just mindlessly eating and you're not even thinking about it or tuning into the taste or the pleasurable experience of eating, it's really easy to keep going because it's not about enjoying it, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people are scared to enjoy food because they think, oh, I'll eat a bunch or I'll overeat. But really, it actually helps tune into what you need to do. So
the other thing that I've been talking to people is about kind of showing them the real world and not shying away from it. Sometimes I think it's the It's the what ifs that don't actually exist that cause the traumas. And what I hear you saying is, well, if I don't put these restrictions on, I will, you know, the you're kind of what ifing. What if I don't have these restrictions? I will eat a dozen donuts. And my response to when anybody says, you know, some sort of really what if negative thing that happened is, will it? Let's lean into that. Okay. What's the worst thing that happens if you kind of go down that path, and really to kind of show them the reality of that, and to see if that is a real reality, a likely reality, or if that's just been a fictionalized trauma.
For sure. Questioning those assumptions is huge, and trying and being a critical, like critically examining your assumptions about bodies, about health, about weight, about nutrition, I think is all really valuable. And yeah, most people do say, well, if I let myself or give myself permission, I'll just eat everything in sight. And you know what? That's not the reality. Like it's just not, because your body has your best interest in mind. And if you're paying attention to it, it's going to be like, hey, we've had enough. You're good.
Love yourself, trust yourself, and have confidence in yourself. Be your own authority.
And if you do find yourself going crazy on it, out of control, there's a good chance that there's still a bunch of restriction and a lack of permission and a lot of self-hate going on in there, which honestly, like, you might need some therapy, you know, like you really just might, because this is deep, really like important.
It's funny. That was going to be my next question is, do you find that some people need just some healing and some therapy before they can really effectively implement intuitive eating?
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure. And it's kind of like a chicken and the egg thing sometimes, because sometimes people are so malnourished from not eating well that they can't cognitively understand the therapeutic kind of interventions that are happening and they can't really do it. And so sometimes it's like you kind of have to be doing both at once so that you can nourish your brain, so that you can support your body to be able to do these things, but, or your mind to be able to kind of wrap your head around these things. But then there definitely are just people who it's like, this has been great. I've loved getting to know you. Come back after you, you know, spend some time working through some of this stuff in therapy, because I don't think we can get anywhere before that.
Well, I just don't see it possible, or maybe possible. It's going to be a lot more difficult if people don't love themselves. And there's just such a deficit of self-love, self-trust, because we have been told not to trust ourselves, not to listen to our own voice. Even when we've been told to listen to the spirit, our own inner voice, it was always through a lens of another authority.
Oh, that's so true. We're not good at this.
We weren't trained to do it, and we weren't given the permission to do it. So I think my message would be, and what I hear your message should be, is do it more and strengthen that muscle.
Practice it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Practice it.
Because I think we're all capable of it. It just requires some patience, some curiosity, not being judgmental, and just kind of experimenting and taking steps in the right direction.
It feels a lot of just hippy dippy love talk.
You know, I'm all about it.
All right, lightning round. Ready? Here comes the hard questions.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Paige. This was fun.
Yeah, this was fun.
So we already hit should or shouldn'ts. Do you have any specific shoulds or shouldn'ts that you ever give?
You should learn to trust yourself.
Okay.
How about that?
Okay, now let's get into some specifics. Sweets or desserts?
As something you should or shouldn't do?
Generally. Sweets or desserts, what's your reaction to that?
I think great, in moderation and enjoying them and being mindful. Yeah.
Okay. Bread.
Okay. I could get on my soapbox about bread.
We're in lightning round. We gotta be concise. Round.
There's nothing wrong with bread. Bread is no different than pasta or rice or corn or any other starchy food. Bread is bread.
Okay.
Which is great. And it tastes delicious.
Here's a loaded one, I know, and I'm doing this intentionally.
Oh dear.
Vegetarianism, veganism.
Great. Honestly, here's what I care about. Are you doing it for the right reasons? Right? Are you doing it for reasons that align with your values? And if so, awesome. And if not, if you're doing it to be socially acceptable restrictor, I'd say question that.
Socially acceptable restrictor. I hear sometimes having a eating disorder and pushing putting it off as veganism. Is that something you've seen?
Yes. And I'm going to be careful not to offend people. Like not every vegan does this, but it is a common thing I see in my office.
Again, be intuitive.
Yeah. And if that truly in your heart is for the reasons that align with your values, I say go for it.
The food pyramid.
Oh, that's so outdated. That's not a thing anymore.
A particular concept of percentage breakup of macronutrients.
I'd say most people, you know, if you just weren't thinking about it, is probably going to fall into the range of macronutrient distribution. And there's no need to like super obsess about it unless you are drinking inordinate amounts of soda or just like only eating like pasta. Like if you're a person who's incorporating balance, you're going to be just fine.
Okay. How about vitamin supplements?
So thanks to Orrin Hatch, vitamins and supplements are not regulated by the FDA. So you never know if what you're buying is actually what you're getting. There are certain medical conditions where supplementation is super necessary and evidence-based. But in general, the research kind of suggests that you're probably just kind of peeing out the nutrients that you're taking in. And also another problem is, you know, things compete for absorption. So you're not necessarily getting 100% of all the things you're taking.
Non-vitamin supplements.
Other same supplements? Answer.
Yeah, other supplements like, I don't know.
Well, I live in Utah where we're like, you know, everybody's going door to door trying to sell their supplements. So I don't have a great opinion of it. Just, I think I think it preys on vulnerable people and that frustrates me. And also the multi-level marketing knocking on the door, trying to sell stuff that you and your buddy made. Is just annoying to me.
Superfoods.
Not a huge fan of the term. I think that
exist in your world, in your mind?
That is not something that I talk with people about, honestly. Like I'm not like, ooh, eat blueberries, you know? Yeah. But I'm not like, don't eat blueberries. It's just like, eat blueberries. But, sure.
But calling them a superfood is...
It's really, gimmicky and not scientific, and that bothers me. And I could go into it, but yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
What are some of the best foods?
you know, I like to think about food in terms of things you want to eat more of and things you want to eat less of. And so that kind of neutralizes it, right? So we want to eat lots of vitamins and minerals. That's what I was about to say. Fruits and vegetables. We want to get whole grains in. We want to get protein and dairy and fats and stuff like that. And we maybe want to eat a little bit, drink a little bit less soda and like eat a little bit fewer sweets when we enjoy.
I just feel like you're looking at me when you mention the soda. Cause you know, I've just got my Coke fix can a day, 32 ounce a day. That's my,
I'm judging you so hard right now.
Right. That's what you've been about this whole time.
I'm the food police. I'm
dogmas.
Just a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think just a general balance and eat in a way that feels good to you and enjoy your fun indulgence here and there and do it guilt-free.
Yeah.
Like your soda.
The worst foods.
The foods that you feel guilty about.
Mm. Okay. Where are some resources? Where can people find you?
So the podcast is Nutrition Matters. I think you already said that. And then, my website, I'm rebranding. So my website is now positive-nutrition.com. So Positive Nutrition is my brand.
Cool.
Yeah.
And don't you have an event or something coming up?
Yeah. So I don't know. Some of your listeners might know Noah Rashetta. Do you know him?
I do. Yeah. His twin brother is one of my closest friends.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. So Noah and I are putting on a workshop in Salt Lake City about mindfulness and eating, and we're so excited about it. And tickets are selling, and it's going to be great. So that's on April 7th, and Noah's going to do kind of his training about mindfulness, and then I'm going to kind of bridge the gap and talk about how that relates to our relationship with food.
That's so, fantastic. Yeah. So check that out. Anyone in the area? Well, so when this doesn't get published, can we get on again? And kidding. I feel really, really confident this gets published.
Oh, good. That was really good. That was fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Hey, this is School of the Teachers, right? Listen, here's another teacher. Bringing the teachers to
you
teach
should,
each other.
You should compile all of this into a book or something.
I keep, you're about the sixth person to suggest writing a book. So I guess I'll write a book.
You should do it. I think yeah. I like the title School of the Teachers. That sounds cool.
Yeah. We'll see where it goes. I think there's a lot of people out there that will have something to say, and we don't have to find prophets or gurus or shaman or life coaches. That the real healers are the teachers. They're the second grade teachers who awaken something in us and yeah. sent us on into the world. And if we can find other people that allow us to do that, that will be the final stage of my creed, my dogma, which is the universe exists, consciousness is, no creeds, no dogmas, follow your intuition,
and
trust yourself.
You're coming right back to Joseph Smith.
Love yourself and be connected.
You're coming
he
right
got
back
it right. He got it very right. He got very close, and then he messed it all up by putting language to it and by creating religion.
Yeah.
So let's create the anti-religion, build schools, not churches.
I love it. I'm super excited about your project. Can't wait to hear it.
Thank you. I'm excited for it as well. You were a unexpected part of it.
Good. So fun. Yeah.
Cool. We'll catch you next time.
Okay, good to talk with you, Matt. Have a good night.
Always good to talk to you.
And I feel like I know your wife because I heard a little episode you guys did together once. I think she's what's her name again?
Kristen.
She seems cool.
She's probably going to get on a little bit more because she is the ultimate teacher.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome.
She's been a teacher for 20 plus years. And
oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
Is very much the inspiration for this because of the way that she pulls things out of kids and awakens them in them. This is very much her, just the way she has done things naturally. So I've just given voice to it and just claimed ownership of it. Said, it's my thing. we've developed this together.
How cool.
Yeah.
Aww. Well, tell her I say hi. No, she
I will.
Know who I am.
She's right here. Kristen okay. Page says hi.
Hi, Paige. You're a big part of my life, Paige.
Oh, my gosh. Oh my gosh, I love you.
Yeah.
That's so fun. So cool.
Hi, my name's Chalice from Clearfield, Utah, and I like listening to Infants on Thrones while shopping at Deseret Industries. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Eat it. Don't you tell me you're full. Just eat it. Eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken. Have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried. Just eat it. Eat it. Just eat it. Eat it. Just eat it. Just eat it.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.